Hello, everyone. You are listening to A Brief History of Power. Colonel Willie Grills and Dr. Adam Kuntz here today to talk to you about a great American, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. But first, Adam, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. How is the weather?
It is sunny, bright, nice, pleasant. I know that's boring. How's yours?
Sunny and pleasant. Everybody's getting their gardens going.
Wow.
I have been for a couple weeks now. It's kind of crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
I even had somebody ask if they wanted, if I could partner with them on a mushroom farm the other day. Edible mushroom. Well, I got to say that a different way. They're all edible, right? Culinary mushrooms.
Culinary mushrooms. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's not Colorado, so.
That's what I was getting ready to say, you know. We could smuggle out there, I guess.
On the other hand, I get to wear a cozy Lands End sweater, and you're already wearing just a t-shirt. So, you know, I mean.
It's true.
There are benefits.
It's rare for me to be the stressed down, but you got to go cash sometimes, you know.
You're a man of the people. I think a little bit unlike J. Edgar Hoover, but.
Right. Well, depending on what group I move in, I can be very much, despite what I said last episode, I can be very much an elitist when I want to be. A lot of my proletariat talking is just cope. As an old stock American, you know, it's sort of there.
Right.
So, yeah, so J. Edgar Hoover kind of taking a little bit of a detour from space exploration and rocketry and talking about something that matters.
Something non-fake. So, yeah.
No, so we got J. Edgar, a man much like Senator McCarthy, who is like the default position on him in sort of normie history books today is negative and always seemed as, you know, something of a dark figure in history.
Yeah.
Being this very self-serving. We'll probably talk, I don't know if we'll get into this because I don't like to get into the seedier side. You know, will we talk about cross-dressing? Will we talk about Clyde Tolson and their relationship? Those sorts of things. Everybody in modern history books who fought for anything traditional in America gets painted as some sort of transvestite or otherwise a deviant, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not, as we might see, I'm not entirely convinced of those things, but we'll get into that a little bit more. It's like a lot of the slanders of great men throughout history. It's just opponents writing things.
Yeah, it's important to realize that if you think about the whole genre of books down to a pretty fairly popular level, even kids books now, called things like People's History. And that originates for us with the People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, is that when you're thinking about modern American history, what you probably were assigned to read in a textbook in high school or maybe even in college is stuff that is written essentially by the people who were deported in World War I. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be key to understanding Hoover. It's also key to understanding why Hoover is portrayed the way he is in movies and in textbooks and so forth, because you have to realize that our government has undergone such radical change in its, not only its size, that's kind of the standard conservative talking point, but also in its orientation in the past 100 years, that somebody who 100 years ago was doing things fairly conventional, fairly widely accepted, as we'll explain when we talk about World War I a little bit later on, is now going to be reviled as an utter hypocrite, like you mentioned, because the people who are writing by the 70s, 80s, and 90s, so people just got upset about textbooks in 2020, they could have gotten upset a lot earlier. Those are the people who either, in some cases genealogically, but in all cases ideologically, are directly connected to the people whom Hoover, along with A. Mitchell Palmer and many other people you may have never heard of, were deporting for being subversive during the First World War and afterward. So you're dealing with a situation where it's kind of like, you know, a militant, very fervent abolitionist writing about Robert E. Lee. It's obviously not going to come out looking and Robert E. Lee is a little harder to besmirch as a human being than J. Edgar Hoover, but that's the equivalent, is that the history is written by people who are on the precisely opposite side of American life from J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. And this is a story that's important. It's not just simply law enforcement trivia or the history of the Bureau.
Right.
This is a very important thing for American history. And, you know, I mean, there really are a few people in the 20th century as influential as J. Edgar.
Right.
Especially as far as American history is concerned.
Yeah.
And so we'll dig into that. So let's just start. Where does J. Edgar Hoover come from?
Yeah. Somewhat unusually, because it's such a small place, he is actually from Washington, D.C. And his father, Dickerson Naylor Hoover, as well as his mother, who I think was the child of German immigrants, relatively recent on that side, on his father's side, kind of older, well, like you said, old stock, you might say, American. But he grows up in D.C. because his father works for the Coast and Geodetic Survey, which has been around forever and basically produced maps and got us ready for engineering projects with rivers and harbors and stuff like that. So because his father is a federal employee, he grows up in D.C. in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And that basically means that he probably will end up working for the federal government. Not necessarily that it will take the turn that it does. His first job, for example, and this precedes our entry into World War I, is essentially as a file clerk for the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this sort of class of people. The federal government is not real big. If you want to go back to the Word Fitly Spoken episode on Ray Winkle, you're going to find a lot of overlap today. And one of those things is Ray Winkle talking, and I think this is the show intro, if I remember correctly, about how small everything was in American life in 1910. And that's where Hoover grows up. So these innocuous bureaucracy jobs, doing things that are actually directly related to something the federal government is supposed to do in the Constitution. that's where he comes up. That's what his father did, and that's what he was prepared to do. The thing that really changes all of this, and the reason that he becomes a figure of such interest, and that's why we're responding to a very recent listener question about this, is because of our entry into the First World War. And at that point, certain things that have been brewing and growing alongside each other, left-wing political activism and even terrorism, along with the desire by the federal government to monitor those things, to have a sense of how to stop them, because we have never been able to before. You have to remember that President McKinley was our most recent assassination, but President Roosevelt, the first President Roosevelt, had been shot as well. And that those things come to a head in World War I, because World War I sets Americans pretty clearly on two very distinct sides, divided up largely by a combination of origin and political affiliation. So if you are German and or most recent immigrants, you are far likelier to be what we would now call left wing, and therefore against America's entry into World War I on the side of Britain and France, than somebody whose ancestors have been here for a long time and who are therefore much likelier, and this is very true for both the Northeast and the Southern United States, to favor entry into World War I on Britain's side. Once we do that, the government says, okay. And we've talked about this before on the show in terms of signals intelligence and monitoring people's communications, but this is really kind of a counterintelligence, or as had been feared earlier, this is something like a secret police comes into being for the first time, because we want to keep track of people who are trying to oppose American efforts in the First World War.
Yeah, and it's a different America than what you're used to, because, you know, essentially, so in the wake of an assassination, right, we get a lot of this that develops, but you have the Treasury Department employees working for the Justice Department, and Congress actually fears secret police. And so then, because of that, we're able to get the formal organization, the Bureau of Investigation.
Right.
I don't think we would balk at all if we said, oh, we've got a whole set of, police dedicated to this collection agency over here, because, we have that. nobody would even bat an eye.
Yeah, right.
We watched the NSA just get, we saw what happened with it after 9/11, and they could get up in all your stuff. And people, to be fair, if you're reading Ron Paul or listening to Alex Jones in those days, you were very much against the concept of secret police and spying and on citizens without cause and things like that. But the average American was all behind it. Everybody forgets that. Everybody forgets, and I know we're way outside of Hoover here, but you could tie this to World War I, you could tie this to World War II as well, that in times of national crises, the Americans tend to be like, yeah, the ends justify the means. Do whatever you need to do. Well, whether right or wrong, we just forget how favorable these agencies were, at least at one time in the public
yeah.
eye.
Yeah, I mean, no question. And this goes back, and the reason we're talking about Hoover is not because of my personal deep interest in the FBI crime lab or something, which I in that actually don't have, but it's because you have to notice two different things at the same time. What the colonel just mentioned precedes World War I proper. The Bureau of Investigation is a result of Theodore Roosevelt's concerns in 1906, 1907, 1908. This is a man who's been shot, okay, for political reasons, and whose predecessor was assassinated by an anarchist, is concerned about the relationship between immigration from Central and Eastern Europe and the growth of anarchism and other, let's say, variants of left-wing politics, which are, and at the time, the reason that the American people are very supportive, particularly after our entry into World War I, of prosecution and deportation of these people is because everyone knows that left-wing politics is more given to terrorism than any variant of what you could call right-wing, or I would call, just in terms of the Democratic and Republican parties, certainly at this time, what you could call simply standard mainstream American politics. The notion that violence would be employed sporadically and without announcement or reason, certainly not in any kind of war setting, but rather by way of terrorism. This is something that is outside everyone's imagination. And the fact that people generally don't know that, or that the largest political attack, terrorist attack in American history is the bombing of LA's main newspaper building in 1919, killing many people. Nobody knows that. Again, this goes back to the idea that the people who were setting off bombs in 1919 now, in an ideological sense, run our country. So,
right. So you're saying the problem is rural white rage?
Yes, right, exactly, right. And so you can notice that the reason this is not really terribly controversial in World War I, as Hoover, who is going to become part of this Bureau of Investigation that is set up as a kind of a successor agency to some of the work that the Pinkertons did against terrorism in the 19th century. As he enters into the Justice Department and he's beginning to investigate what are called alien enemies, nobody is really thinking, oh, this is really bad per se. Mm-hmm. This is evil per se. And that's because we're not assuming that if someone like Emma Goldman or Alexander Berkman, who had tried to kill Henry Clay Frick back in the 1890s, nobody's assuming that someone who is not an American citizen has rights to come into America and do and say whatever he pleases.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Hoover kind of begins, really his ascent, thanks to Woodrow Wilson. And so right at the beginning of World War I, you've got the 1917 Espionage Act.
Yeah.
And Hoover's going to be right there in the middle of authority to deport whom he needs to. So he investigates suspicious Germans and arrests a lot, deports a fair number of them. And so from there, he becomes the head of the so-called Radical Division. And that's where we get into the Bureau of Investigation, which is not yet the FBI.
Right.
It's the precursor to it. It's coming. And this is really where you start to get the picture of Hoover, like kind of the stereotypical one, right? So he's going after radicals, which at the time are viewed, and probably rightly, as dangerous figures in a lot of cases, or at least disruptive figures. Painted today as, oh, he's just going after people who thought differently. And so he's arresting them for thought crimes. Yeah. And people forget that, you know, we're not talking about like Minority Report here, like, oh, you were going to commit this crime because you were thinking about it. But I would remind you that Jesus said that sin begins in the heart, so just throwing it out there for the sake of discussion. But the thought leaders in these movements are the ones who are stoking the fires that causes what are generally the lower level ones to go out and to bomb or to assault or whatever.
Yeah.
And we forget, this isn't just a case of bombings and things like that. It's the wobbly showing up at a, you know, in farm country in Iowa and Minnesota trying to radicalize Norwegians and things like that. Impossible to do, but they tried.
They're and too nice. It only worked on nice the Finns them. And the Swedes. Right.
Yeah. Of course, naturally. And so, but he is from the beginning, you know, part of this Radicals Division, which is a cool name. But this is, we think of the Red Scare as a Cold War thing, but really it goes back to 1919 or yeah. 1917.
Yeah.
And people are already worried about him. Even the Supreme Court justice is worried about Hoover at this point.
Yeah.
Because he is seen as dangerous because he is so aggressive.
Well, the term Red Scare is kind of like, before it was, you know, the favorite podcast of the Nietzschean right. Before then, it is a term a lot like Dark Ages.
Yeah, yeah.
In that it's invented by the people who had the least to gain from what was regnant or obvious or clear at the time. And that is people who are red or at least pink.
Yeah. Same thing as witch hunt. You know,
yeah, right.
People say Red Scare and witch hunt to try to imply there were no reds or no witches.
Right.
When
yeah,
categorically there were both of those things.
there were both. And something that, you know, I actually have seen this in certain forms of media. The beginning, for instance, of the series Boardwalk Empire mm-hmm. does show you reds actually bombing people's homes. But by way of at least explaining for the purposes of plot why there was any hunting down of anyone affiliated with the far left, you might say, or the left beyond mm-hmm. anything inside the Democratic or Republican or progressive bull moose parties. So this is something where if you don't believe it's real, of course, all of this looks crazy. If you believe it's real, the question that you have to ask yourself once you have kind of overcome your Ron Paul priors is, you know, which we're all doing, right?
Everybody's recovering.
We're all still disappointed. Are there things that are out of bounds as far as what you think, what you say, and certainly what you do by means of political or religious expression in American life? And if you just think about, Colonel Grills mentioned the Espionage Act of 1917, that is in a chain of legislation dating back to when we were sort of fighting a war against France in the 1790s that led to the Alien and Sedition Acts. Again, those two things associated with each other. So you have to ask yourself, is America a place that you can say and do whatever you want? And here's a fundamental betrayal of that promise. Or is there a political mainstream, a religious mainstream, certainly a mainstream of political action? Like, you can't shoot other people randomly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That
controversial take.
Right. That explains why Americans react the way they do. I mean, think about the way that, I mean, when John Wilkes Booth shot President Lincoln, look not only at how he was hunted down, we actually executed a woman for helping him.
Yeah. Well, one of the things the listeners need to understand, because this is one of the most commonly taught things in history, in American history, right? Who killed Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah.
And they say John Wilkes Booth. And they forget there's an entire conspiracy here going after other members of the cabinet and
right.
Multiple people taken in and then hanged for this.
Yes.
But history remembers the one guy when it actually was technically a conspiracy
it
by
was
any
a
definition.
conspiracy. Yeah.
And so Hoover is going to, by Calvin Coolidge, be named head of the Bureau of Investigation. He'll be the
right.
fifth head.
Yeah.
He's only the first head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but we're not there yet.
Right.
Hoover comes in, takes over, fires all female agents, and bans them from hire. And so it's kind of interesting because we think of, it's kind of hard to think about in 1920 there being female FBI agents, or I mean female proto-FBI agents, because we don't have the FBI
right.
yet.
Yeah. Right.
And that's an interesting history too, because there was, like in a few cases, like women lawyers, especially in the Prohibition era, they were there was actually a progressive bent. And in almost every case, when a woman was hired and put in a position of prominence, especially a prosecutorial one, she was, even though she would follow through with, you know, Prohibition stuff, very much on the left of the spectrum.
Yes,
politically.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And Prohibition is part of, let's say, the homegrown version of the American left, in the same way that the populist movement was.
Yeah. And so, people don't know, you know, much about when he first starts. They don't know where Hoover's coming from, and you know, they don't like his tactics. They don't like his managerial style, but he's going to persist until the 70s. Obviously, something he's doing is effective. He was very picky. He did micromanage, and I'm getting all this out in the front because these are things that are going to go through all of his career.
Yeah, right.
He is going to absolutely know who is being assigned to what. In most cases. And if he doesn't like you, you're not getting a good assignment.
Right.
And this is where a lot of people say, well, see, he was bad, blah, blah, blah. And I find it interesting because you have the example here of the classic strongman, the man who was put into authority and he's going to exercise that authority. And well within his authority to assign and reassign agents. Okay. Now, bear with me here. People who listen to this podcast will go, well, that's awful. That is just dictatorial. Anyway, we need bishops in order to fix the church. And so I would submit.
We need unmarried men with rules right. of time on their hands and nothing else to think about and no other legacy to dictate what the church should do. Right, exactly. Right. Yeah.
We're putting a little hole in my theory here because I'm actually endorsing a childless man running everything. But my point being that if you want bishops, this is what you're getting. You're getting an effective bishop is a J. Edgar because he has to know what his agents are doing.
Yeah.
And if they're not doing what they should do, he has to have the sand to get rid of them and to move them or to expel them. And you might think, okay, he did it in a wrong way, but the principle still stands that this is what strong leadership has to do a lot of times. J. Edgar Hoover had never heard of a team building Zoom class, you know?
He did not do emotional intelligence for sure.
No, the EQ was low. Didn't need it. Had a bureau run.
In a way, it was extremely high. He knows which buttons to push on human beings. In another way, it's very, very low. Doesn't care.
I mean, it is impressive. Whether right or wrong, his ability to turn the screw is pretty, pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So let's kind of, because the meat of this stuff comes once the FBI proper is founded,
right?
Which is going to put us up into the 30s,
right?
You know, before we get into that, I mean, we're getting into, you know, we're already in Prohibition at this point, and people might not realize that, you know, the Office of Prohibition is connected to the Treasury Office. It's very much about collections and things like that in a way that we don't think about today, even though the connections are still very much there. You know, the FBI, IRS, the legacy of what we're going to talk about here, they're all armed now and they're all coming for you if you break the law. So it's still there.
Right.
If you don't pay your VIG, they're going to come at you in a certain way. So not new. That part has not really changed that much. There was still a lot of Prohibition agency stuff going on, and the FBI sort of will come in and kind of take over that in a lot of ways.
Right.
Because the investigations get complicated. Okay, so I'm going to go arrest a guy with a still because he's not paying taxes, but now he's shot a federal agent, so who's going to come in and take over? It gets a little messy.
Yeah.
And if you read the reports of the time, there is a lot of bumping up against each other of various agencies, who has hierarchy. In that way, the Prohibition Act was kind of a mess. Unenforceable due to staffing, who really has say here when this happens.
Right.
And eventually it all gets handed over to the Justice Department, of course, once you're talking about the courts. But eventually the FBI is going to win out. It's going to be created, and it's going to, at least in the public eye, take over. All of these other agencies, the ones that existed today and the ones that exist a little bit after, are still tasked with pretty much the same thing, but eventually the FBI becomes this big thing that overshadows all of them, whether that's jurisdictional or not. It becomes a much, much bigger thing under J. Edgar.
Right. Yeah, he sets it up as something that once the, let's say, what's called the first Red Scare, if you're looking these things up, passes in about the early to mid 1920s, he's going to set up the Bureau of Investigation, and then in 1935, renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation as a kind of national police force, not therefore policing everything, but going especially after interstate crimes, things where if the guy is running a still that he crosses from Tennessee into North Carolina or vice versa, now the FBI can get involved. He's going to set it up with a lot of things, particularly the forensic investigation into crime that will make the FBI simply more capable than almost any local police force, into something that will always be there in a way that the Bureau of Prohibition, other agencies and things that will be born after the Second World War are just do not parallel, cannot equal.
Yeah. Well, he's going to essentially institute things that are normal today.
Yes, right.
He modernizes law enforcement almost singularly because fingerprint databases, all the forensic stuff, all the stuff that like your folks are watching at home on TV, on reruns, you know, on their crime shows.
Yeah.
Have their genesis in J. Edgar Hoover. It just didn't happen. And that's hard to think about. You know, now you get a fingerprint in a crime scene, you can scan it to a national database, and spooky as that may be, it's a lot easier to track this down. That didn't exist until Hoover modernized law enforcement.
Right.
And so fingerprints, forensics, blacklists, he's got them all. Now, we always had blacklists, but now they're federalized. Now they're nationalized.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And so in 1933, the Bureau of Investigation gets linked up with the Bureau of Prohibition. For a couple years, they're named the Division of Investigation. But in 1935, we've got the FBI christened as we know it. And so from the early mid-20s to the early 70s, you know, J. Edgar Hoover is kind of the man as far as this goes. And that Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, I think now just called FBI Lab, might be his greatest legacy, if you think about it. You know, take out all the Red Scare stuff, take out the fact that he even investigated the Klan. You know, that is really, that's his fingerprint, no pun intended, all over. You know, I mean, that's his legacy.
Yeah.
It's just simply that.
Yeah, because I think that that provides the tools for something that will be then imitated endlessly in all kinds of other agencies and in the state versions. You know, you have a Bureau of Investigation in most American states, maybe all American states, under some name or another. That if you don't have those tools, if you don't have the technology to keep track and to follow up, the fact that you are interested in any enormous array of political movements for any wide number of political and metapolitical purposes doesn't matter, because you can't keep track of these things, right? You could have a secret police in Tsarist Russia, but Tsarist Russia doesn't have the technology to monitor people when they move around. If Hoover is able to keep track of people, and this is where the notion of his files, which is in its own way kind of apocryphal, certainly in their extent, but that he's keeping track, the significance there is that Hoover is now setting a pattern for the way that American government and therefore also American life will work, that if you rise to any kind of position of prominence in any way, individually or as some kind of group, the government will now be keeping track of you. And that just gets more and more and more extended to everybody has a photo ID, everybody's going to have a real ID, etc. that isn't possible unless the government develops these tools to do so. And Hoover's the one that's able to marry the technology to the ambition. And for that reason, I mean, I don't actually personally think this is good at all, but he's really important, even whether you like his political purposes or not, because he is one of the first to say, I mean, he's literally a creature of DC. I'm going to live here in the Imperial headquarters and keep track of everything, and I'm going to do it effectively. And he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So let's start digging in then. Okay, so we talked about the Red Scare a little bit.
Yeah.
So what else is the FBI up to?
Some of this he's not actually terribly interested in, but sort of has
part of the gig.
Right, it's part of the gig. And there's a lot of speculation about this, and I'll provide my own in a second, is that he's not nearly as interested in organized crime as you might imagine he should be. Because the thing that everyone concedes for or against prohibition, everyone concedes about American life, is that the absolute explosion of the power and the scope of organized crime is enormous in the 20s and 30s. And Hoover is really dodgy about admitting that it exists and then prosecuting, particularly some of its most obvious activities, especially gambling. It's not an accident that Las Vegas, as we know it, built around and on gambling, was also built by organized crime. And Hoover was something of a gambler himself, but that doesn't, I mean, just because you have a private vice doesn't mean that you want everyone to have that private vice necessarily and are going easy on it. So one of the things, this is my speculation, one of the things I think you see in Hoover is something you'll also see in the history of the CIA after the Second World War, is that the American government begins to accept the existence of organized crime and to work with it. And even at times, and this is particularly clear in the history of the CIA, even through it, just sort of accepting it as a power in the same way that they accept that Congress exists.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. When talking about this thing of ours, well, and this is where you get into the Hoover conspiracy theories, right?
Yeah.
He didn't go after the mafia, if it exists, because the so-called mafia, because they had blackmail on him.
Right.
But again, there's no real evidence of this.
There is not, no.
I think a simpler explanation is that the mob, in a lot of ways, see, this changes, and I'll get to that in a minute. The mob is not like the movies where everybody's getting gunned down. That happens, and then the FBI really clamps down on it, and they quit it.
Right.
You know, a lot of the large, and that's the same thing with the bank robbers, the gangsters, as we call them, which aren't the mafia proper, but the, you know, the Pretty Boy Floyds and stuff like that.
Your homegrown heartland criminals.
Exactly. Which is why the FBI had a big presence in the Midwest at first. People forget this.
Right.
Well, and we also forget about the so-called mafia in Kansas City. But anyway, they do not go after the mafia hard until well after Hoover is dead, in large part until the mafia gets into drugs. And then the federal government comes after them. I think a simpler explanation is kind of Western related. So you watch every Western movie, and it's not history, but you start digging in the history books, little small towns, Methodist church on one side of the street, brothel on the other. How are these? And nobody ever asked, how was this legal, right? It wasn't that there weren't laws against it. These were still, you know, it was what it is.
Yeah.
And in some cases there weren't, but in a lot of cases there were. And gambling, a lot of these things were seen as lesser vices.
Yes, correct.
And so they just, look, we're dealing with potential left-wing terrorism here. We've got a lynching over here. We've got whatever over here. This is kind of a thing that funnels itself.
That's great.
And so we're not going to touch it.
That's
in
great.
The same way.
The greatest American Western, Oakley Hall's Warlock. It's sort of a fictionalization of the story of Tombstone, Arizona. You will notice that the incessant choice that the townspeople have, that the various kinds of law have, that the criminals and rustlers have, is choosing to either permit possibly ultimate disorder in order to handle lesser vices or to tolerate lesser vices, because life is just naturally full of disorder.
Exactly.
In order to impose some kind of basic order. So it would be better to have the brothel open across the street or the saloon open across the street from the Presbyterian mission than it would be to have a situation where all of that is probably still going on anyway, but a man could be gunned down in broad daylight.
Yeah.
And that is a selection that I think the American government makes as it realizes that particularly when you have organized forms of crime, which are largely the product of 19th century immigrant groups, Italians, Jews, Irish, that have a sense of solidarity outside the mainstream of American life. And they therefore coordinate their activities, and they have all the resources of the cities to which they've immigrated. We're going to tolerate that, and we're even going to work with it sometimes in order to make sure that we don't have an America where the president can be shot randomly.
Right.
Or innocent people standing at a train station can be blown up because some communist is upset about something.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And who, when there are shootings related to the mafia, it's usually an internal kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
And so, right or wrong, it doesn't get quite the same priority as a attack on random civilian.
Correct. Yep.
And it's hard for us to understand today, because it's a day where everybody's got a camera on their phone and they're filming every jaywalker wondering why this person isn't getting thrown into the pokey.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a perspective that you're going to have if you assume that people generally mean well and life is generally orderly, and then any disorder is just obviously, you know, needs to be stopped immediately. Once you zoom out far enough, you realize disorder is natural and order is rare. And so if you're going to try to impose order in some kind of way, you have to make choices about when and where you're going to focus.
Right. And so all these theories come up. Oh, does Meyer Lansky have blackmail? Do these people know something about him? I think the answer we gave is much more simple and probably closer to the truth.
Historically plausible and provable.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, and not just in American history, but pretty much through all of history, that legal principle we talked about exists.
Right.
So, to get into too many specifics about FBI activities, but we have to talk about the elephant in the room. The secrecy behind J. Edgar's private life. Is it true? Was he romantically involved with his friend Clyde Tolson, who was the heir of his estate and who is buried very close to him?
Yeah. I think it's very possibly true. That doesn't mean that I'm hinging everything I'm thinking about Hoover in terms of, you know, he is just an absolute hypocrite. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. There's a lot that's kind of odd about Clyde Tolson. I think this little detail, it has stuck in my mind as I've thought about it, is that when Hoover dies in 1972, he is laid in state in the Capitol Rotunda. And after that is concluded, when the service is concluded for that, and they're going to then bury him, the flag from his coffin is handed to Clyde Tolson.
Right.
Which, if you don't know that, you know, if your husband dies in Vietnam, at his funeral, you, his wife, receive the flag that was on his coffin. So this is that's pretty weird.
It's unorthodox. But you know, but enough about Cardinal Newman. But one's much more sketchy to me. But that's an episode for another day.
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, a lot that's going to be said about this, and what Hoover did, et cetera, and what did Meyer Lansky know, and so forth, is really based on two different things. One is the assumption that people generally have today that if you have some kind of moral principle, it's because you are repressing that thing in yourself. So if you have any moral principles against sexual deviancy, whatever, it's because you yourself like those things and you are self-loathing, and that gets expressed as a moral principle in public. Okay. So that's the assumption about human beings most people are making, because a lot of people, especially left-wing writers talking about these things, cannot imagine that somebody would both have a moral principle and not be morally perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing that they're assuming is something that we try to just debunk, which is that somehow secret files on all sorts of sides are the actual source of how and why people do things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an old red herring in history. If you look at the Byzantines, who also have a very complex centralized government and a large intelligence network, this is all in the Middle Ages. They also have a giant genre of history called secret histories, the most famous of which is Procopius. And that basically says that no matter what you thought the emperor was doing, what was actually happening was that he and his wife had very strange things going on. And therefore, he was under the control of her butler or something, right?
Yeah.
And the problem there is, do I have to believe you? No, I don't. And it's this kind of thing is always based on hearsay. So particularly about Hoover, the most salacious stuff is based on the hearsay of people who are like some gangster's third or fourth wife, who was herself, in the case of Susan Rosenstiel, tried for perjury, convicted of perjury. So,
well, it's always something like Roy Cohn's in the background, you know, which already makes it shady. You know, another thing is, it's a little tangential to this, but regarding Tolson and J. Edgar, maybe bros are just being bros.
Yeah,
you know, that's the thing.
Right.
Like, and male friendship, very different.
you know,
and we've talked about this before in other episodes.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the problem, like you said, you know, with our society. You know, everybody who's against something's actually secretly for it. The other thing that the modern mind does, modern philosophy does, is sexualize everything.
Yes.
So that if two individuals are close, it has to be a sexual relationship.
Right.
It can't just be platonic. Just be bros.
Yeah, it's not even a possibility in people's minds anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a shame. I mean, could just be close bros, and he got his flag. It happens. You know, I don't know. I choose to believe they were bros.
Yeah, and I mean, that's fine, because it's not like the alternative is somehow provable.
Exactly.
And even if it were, it's not, and it can't be, a complete explanation of why he consistently opposes left-wing terrorism his entire career.
Well, yeah, they try to say he shouldn't have gone after all of these bad guys because he was gay. It's a really weird argument.
It also fails to understand something, which was still sort of a commonplace maybe when you and I were born, and may have been on the books in various agencies, which was, if you have an unorthodox private life, you not only are just very, very frequently left-wing, which we now see readily and openly in our society, that is, the stranger your proclivities, the farther left your politics, almost without fail. But also that if you have an unorthodox private life, and this is why instead you would want to hire Mormons in the FBI, because if you have an unorthodox private life, you are going to be subject to compromise at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
Because anytime you clock out, whatever kind of work you're doing, you're investigating bank robbers, kidnappers, you're investigating communists, whatever, anytime you clock out, now you are entering your own compromised position, because what you're doing and how you live, whether you are addicted to gambling or whether you are addicted to other things that are at that time unmentionable, you're very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you hire, and this is part of the reason why Mormons come to be so integral to the FBI, if you clock out and you go home to Susan and your five kids,
right,
and you know, play ball in the yard, and then you go to sleep and get up the next morning, that might be presented as square or stupid or whatever, but at least it's trustworthy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that's just completely lost.
Yeah.
So, all right. So we got his private life out of the way. Now, heading up toward the end of this, you know, we're getting into the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Our boy Nixon is even afraid of Hoover. Why might that be?
And this is a very rare case because Nixon was not a shrinking violet. In,
right.
You know, guy didn't know how to play poker when he entered the Navy in World War II, learns poker, makes a small fortune that he's going to use to set up his political career after the war.
A self-made man.
Yeah, right. So generally not worried about the fact that he doesn't understand what's going on. Nixon is afraid to fire Hoover when he's inaugurated in 68, because he's worried that Hoover will get back at him. Now, Hoover already had passed the mandatory federal retirement age in 64, and LBJ had that basically made a carve out for him so he didn't have to retire. Mm-hmm. So he's already passed. He's entering his 70s as the country, as the world enters, the century enters the 70s. And Nixon cannot fire him because he's worried about reprisal. This, to me, is one of maybe alongside, you know, wedding the technology to the question of surveillance. This is so significant about Hoover that this is an incredible executive power that has nothing to do with the president of the United States. Not really.
Correct.
Because it endures, it pre-exists and endures beyond him.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Lyndon Johnson would be the one. It's actually during, well, of course, it's during the Kennedy assassination, it's during Hoover's time that
yeah.
Johnson pressures Congress to make any assault or assassination of a federal official federal crime. Like to be investigated by basically the FBI.
Right.
That the FBI did not have, like, if you shot the president in Omaha, Omaha police took that over and not the FBI.
Right.
Which is insane to think about.
Wild. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Different world. Yep.
And that wasn't that long ago.
Yep.
No, everywhere he went, it was increasing federal power, which kind of brings us to our last point then.
Yeah.
Does the uncontrolled growth of the FBI, and in particular, one man's authority, does that contribute to what we might call the deep state today? And we only briefly mentioned the CIA and things like that. But, you know, what does that mean as we look at that? Like, what is the deep state?
Yeah, deep state has a different meaning when it originally is used. And it comes from very early in Hoover's career, but it's from Turkey, not from the United States. And deep state implies secrecy, mm-hmm. that what you're dealing with is, I'm speaking originally here, that what you're dealing with is unseen and unofficial. It exists, but it is basically another name for a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the same sense that Dr. Samuel Mudd, who treats John Wilkes Booth, is arrested for assisting and being part of a conspiracy, the deep state implies that you don't see what the connections are. Okay. That would be something more like, okay, what exactly are Hoover's connections to Meyer Lansky or Hoover's connections to Bebe Rebozo, who is really important both for the Kennedy assassination and for Nixon's rise to power and where Nixon spends his vacations in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something like a deep state. The fact that you have agencies of federal power that are something like a official national secret police, such as was feared before Teddy Roosevelt, or that someone is in power for half a century
mm-hmm.
over such an agency like Hoover was, that's not really a deep state. That's just a state.
right.
And so the question here is not just what kind of secret power is there. I mean, I think that's a valid question. But Nixon is not afraid because he fears that J. Edgar Hoover, you know, works in the Library of Congress, but secretly is connected to the military and to special forces or something. It's because things that are right out there in the open about American life are set up to make and in fact can make the president afraid.
Mm-hmm.
That are all technically under his jurisdiction.
Right, but
right. So yeah. So
that's the president's just elected for 1 to 2 terms.
That's,
you know?
Correct. Right. So this idea that there's coming and going in the government, whether you're talking about Congress or the presidency or whatever, means that what is opposing Nixon or what is opposing Trump or whatever? It's not just, you know, secret connections between people. Let me connect the dots. Look at this, you know, PowerPoint slide with a million bubbles on it, with lines between the bubbles. It's all right out there, right? I mean, Hoover, Hoover's doing things he was authorized to do. He's also doing unauthorized things, I'm sure, but he's mostly doing things he was always authorized to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, all right, so there is the deep state then. So we've really, I mean, folks, this is a very short episode for a guy who's got a lot of stuff in his biography, and it's worth checking out. I didn't even talk about J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, and Smith & Wesson. And
no,
so
you did. You did somehow.
It's a banner day. I have control.
That's for the Patreon.
That's right. We're going to put that behind the paywall. No, so it's a case where you're able to make a historic figure into a cartoon character, and in this case, a cartoon villain, or look at him for what he was.
Yeah.
And so you can disagree with his methods. That's fine.
Yeah.
But it does seem as if he was on the side of his country. And he is painted often as just a man, you know, only going after what's good for J. Edgar.
Right.
Maybe that's true, maybe that's not. I can't really judge the man's heart. We're a long way from 1972. But his methods were effective, largely. And he revolutionizes crime investigation.
Right.
Sets the standard for that. But again, to go back to what we've said at the beginning of the episode, he is very much your strongman. He's the one that a lot of people out there claim that they want. Well, if you want that, this is exactly what it looks like. Here's a modern example of someone who can effectively wield more power than the president. You know, based on a couple of things. If you subscribe to the blackmail theory, sure. But I think a lot of it is just sheer force of will and influence and people behind
it. Yeah.
And you can't take that away.
And I think that this, whether you're going to just call it a state, an administrative state, a bureaucratic state, a police state, or you're going to call it a deep state, which I think is a higher level of proof because you have to then prove networks and conspiracies, a la, you know, Lincoln assassination, as we brought up, whatever you're doing, I do think that these, though they have their own power in the way that institutions have power to shape people's thinking and behavior, they are ultimately, they are functions of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the idea that the director of the FBI somehow matters is a legacy of J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because it absolutely had to, and that, you know, by some kind of divine fiat, the Defense Intelligence Agency was condemned to obscurity. Right.
Very well said. Yeah.
Yeah. That the state is a function of the people who are in the state, in addition to whatever institutional power it has over those people. If it has completely different people, they may have many of the same powers, but they will not be capable of exercising them in the same way. Nobody has replaced Hoover. He's been succeeded in office. He has not been replaced.
Mm-hmm.
No successor, anything like him, has ever come into this office since. And I don't think that's an accident on the part of the presidency either.
Right.
But he has had no success.
Yeah, we'll try doing that again.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, very well said. Well, any final words for the folks at home about J. Edgar?
Yeah, you want to combine the kind of stuff that we've been talking about today with the Ad Astra episodes and a lot of other things that we've said and will say about modern history, because a study like the life of J. Edgar Hoover is significant not just for the nooks and crannies of it, but for the overall stream of noticing how much more important technology and government surveillance becomes determining all kinds of facets of life, and not just the political speech of very, very left-wing people. In time, this is a pattern that gets set for how the federal government particularly relates to every American, wherever you came from or however recently or whatever your political leanings are. And without somebody like Hoover, whatever he intended to do, nobody of any political stripe in 2024 would be surveilled to the extent or with the thoroughness and frequency that the FBI does.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well, this has been a brief history of power. Colonel Grills and Dr. Kuntz, you know where to find us.
A martyr's death, the hero's life. The theme for the 10th Men's Gathering being held this year at Lakeview Villages on April 4th to 7th. We are thrilled to have secured Pastor Brian Wolfmuller as our main speaker this year. Join 150 Christian men to learn how the martyrs of the early Christian church still preach to us with their lives, their lips, and their blood. Arrive as early as Thursday for a special Brews and Cues session with Pastor Wolfmuller, or stay as late as Monday to watch the full solar eclipse, which will be directly over the villages. Visit mensgathering.us for more details and to register. We hope you can join us at the 2024 Men's Gathering, a proud supporter of A Brief History of Power.
Are you interested in entering into or fostering a biblical marriage? If so, set aside May 3rd to 5th, 2024, and join other young Lutherans and keynote speaker Dr. Adam Kuntz, that's me, for a conference on biblical marriage at Grace Lutheran Church in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. Come and learn what it means to have a godly marriage, participate in the divine service, meet like-minded folks, enjoy fellowship, and even learn a barn dance. We welcome singles, couples looking to get married, the newly married, and families. If you're a young couple, bring your third wheels, because you just might end up with a fourth. Don't hesitate and register today at whatgodhasjoinedtogether.ca. That's all one word, whatgodhasjoinedtogether.ca. Your marriage is worth a trip to the Great White North.
Are you tired of people saying that you must accept the crumbling of Christianity? Are you looking for a place that hasn't embraced the new normal? A church that isn't taking the decline of Christian culture, families, and congregations sitting down? Are you looking for reverent liturgy and biblical teaching that proclaims the mercy of God and instructs you in holy living? Then visit Mission of the Cross Lutheran Church in Cross Lake, Minnesota, where people come for the beautiful lakes, but they stay for the church, where we are reclaiming Christendom.
Are you looking for a Christ-centered healthcare provider? One that values life no matter the stage and knows that we are made in the image of God and thus have inherent regenerative abilities? Or are you a healthcare provider looking to escape the increasingly woke system that employs you? Direct eCare can help. We are a concierge telehealth company founded by a cradle Lutheran who takes his God-given vocation seriously. We offer our patients direct, unfettered access to our providers with unlimited, as-needed telehealth services for only $35 per month or $370 per year. We are currently able to provide care to patients in the state of Idaho only, but are actively seeking providers in other states that would like to partner with us to start their own direct e-care clinic. Whether you are a prospective patient or an interested provider, you can learn more at www.directe-care.com.